hedgerow into a flickering kaleidoscope of yellow, green and black. And even as Harry watched, so the Frigis Express truck woofed by. A short Mobius jump took them a mile further down the road, where they exited inside a catwalk spanning the A1's multiple lane system. And a minute later, Harry said, "Here he comes." They gazed down through the walkway's windows, watched the Frigis Express truck thunder by beneath them to rumble on down the road. As its lights diminished and merged with those of the rest of the night traffic, Penny asked, "What now?" Harry shrugged and checked their location. "Borough Bridge is a mile or two further south," he said. "Johnny might stop there or might not. In any case, I don't intend to monitor his progress mile by mile. But I do know that somewhere along the line he'll call a halt, probably at an all-night diner. That's his modus operandi, right? It's his venue, the hunting ground where he finds his victims, women on their own, in the dead of the night. Except, I don't have to tell you that, do I?" Penny shuddered.
"No, you don't have to tell me that."
They looked around. On one side of the road was a petrol station, on the other a diner. Harry said, "I'm happy now that I can find Johnny any time I want him, so let's take a break for a coffee, okay? And I can maybe explain something of how I want to play it." She nodded and even managed a shaky smile.
"Okay."
They headed along the walkway towards steps leading down to the cafeteria. People were coming up the steps, heading back to the petrol station and its car park. Before they could climb up to the walkway's level, Penny grabbed Harry's arm.
"Your eyes!" she hissed.
Harry put on his dark glasses, then took her hand. "Lead me," he said. "You know, like I was a blind man." It wasn't a bad idea. From then on, in the cafeteria where a handful of travellers were eating, people only looked at them once and quickly looked away. It's a funny thing, Harry thought, but people don't much look at someone with an affliction, or if they do, they look sideways. They'd jump sideways if they knew the nature of my affliction. But they didn't. Not all of them, anyway. On the bank of the river some little way from Bonnyrigg, Ben Trask and Geoffrey Paxton stood in the dark of the night under the moon and stars and listened to the gurgle of blackly swirling waters. They listened for other things too, but heard nothing. And they watched. They watched the old house across the water, the house of the necroscope with all its lights ablaze, watched it for movement behind the open ground floor patio doors, for shadows falling on the fabric of the curtains in the upper windows, for any sign of life, or absence of life, undeath. And watching it, they fingered their weapons. Trask, his submachine gun, with a magazine of 39mm rounds seated firmly in its blue steel housing, and Paxton, his metal crossbow, loaded with a hardwood bolt under pressure sufficient to hammer through a man like a nail into soft wood. A mile away, on the road to Bonnyrigg, two more E-Branch operatives sat in their car waiting. They had small talents of their own, but weren't telepaths. Neither one of them had Ben Trask's experience or Paxton's zeal, but if it became necessary, certainly they would be able to do whatever must be done. Their car was equipped with radio tuned in on London HQ. At the moment, their job was simply to relay messages and act as backup for the men up front. If Trask or Paxton called them, they could pick them up in little more than a minute, which at least gave the men on the riverbank a feeling of security. Paxton a little less than Trask, for he had been here before. "Well," Trask whispered now, taking the telepath's elbow, "is he in there or isn't he?" Standing close to the very spot where Harry Keogh had tossed him into the river, Paxton was nervous. The necroscope had warned him that next time, that there had better not be a next time. And now that time was here, and Trask's hand still gripped Paxton's arm just above the elbow. The telepath shook his head.
"I don't know, but the house is tainted for sure. Can't you feel it?"
"Oh, yes," Trask nodded in the dark. "Just looking at it, I can see it's not right."
"What about the girl?" "An hour ago she was here, definitely," the other answered. "Her thoughts were clouded, mind smog, yes, but readable to a degree. She's enthralled to him, no doubt about it. I thought Keogh was here too. In fact, I was sure he was, briefly. But now, He shrugged. Telepathy with vampires is a very tricky business. To see without being seen and to hear without being heard.
Before Trask could answer him or make further comment, a tiny red light began to flash on his pocket walkie-talkie. He extended the aerial and pressed the incoming call button. There sounded the customary wash of background static and then the quiet, faintly tinny voice of Guy Teal, saying,
"Carr here. How do you read me?"
"Okay," Trask answered him soft and low. "What's up?"
"We've had a call from HQ,"
Teal came back.
"We're to move to final strike locations now. Situate ourselves. From there on in, maintain radio and ESP silence and wait for the word."
Trask frowned and said, "We can ready ourselves, sure. But how will we be able to strike if our target isn't here? Ask HQ that, will you?"
Without pause, Teal came back.
"HQ says that in the event there's no one in the house when they give the word, we remain in situ, stay alert, and wait to see what happens."
Trask's frown deepened. "Ask them to repeat that, will you? With some of the blanks filled in."
"I already did."
Teal's sigh was clearly audible.
"Before I even called you. As far as HQ knows, Keo had the Sanderson girl with him, and he and she are on to the serial killer. Likewise, we have people on Keo and Found, within limits, that is, and also people on Trevor Jordan on a night train bound to London. So we'll let Keo and or the police settle with Found, then move in on the Necroscope, the girl and Jordan simultaneously, wherever they are at the time."
Trask nodded. "So if our people don't get Harry at their end, and if he escapes back here, we'll be waiting for him, right?"
"That's how I see it,"
Teal answered.
"Okay, secure the car and come in on foot. Meet us at the old bridge, ready to cross in 10 minutes. Then we'll reorganize, split into two pairs, and choose vantage points at the front and rear of the house. That's all for now. Be seeing you."
He pressed the off button. Paxton, nervously scanning all around in the darkness under the trees, said,
"Do you think Teal and Robinson will be okay working together? I mean, I'm sure we'll be fine together, but they don't strike me as having a hell of a lot of candle power between them."
"You're probably right." Trask stared hard at him in the dark of the night, disliking everything that he saw and felt, especially the fact that every now and then he'd feel Paxton's talent tugging on the covers of his mind and trying to turn them back.
"So I'll team up with Teal, and you take Robinson."
Paxton turned more fully toward him, and his eyes were slightly feral in fleeting moonlight.
"You don't want us to work together?"
"Paxton, let me put you right," Trask told him. "The only reason I wanted to work with you up here in the first place was to keep an eye on you. See, I think you're full of it, and it's leaking on your attitude. So you're right, I don't want us to work together. In fact, I'd rather work with raw shit."
Paxton scowled and started to turn away, make tracks back up to the road. But Trask caught him by the arm and turned him around.
"Oh, and there's one other thing, Mr. Hugely Talented Telepath. I've about 90% had it with you trying to read my mind. When I'm 100% pissed off, you'll be the first to know it. Because after that, Harry Keogh won't be the only one who has ever tossed you in the river, right?"
Paxton was wise enough to say nothing. They returned to the road in silence, made their way to the old stone bridge over the river, waited for Teal and Robinson to join them there. Harry and Penny had finished their first coffees half an hour ago. Now they had seconds which were going cold in their cups. Penny had tried a cream cake, too, from which she'd taken just one bite. She wasn't sure if it was the cake or her mood, but since nothing tasted right, it was probably her mood. Every so often the Necroscope would reach into his inside pocket and take Johnny's hideous steel tube weapon into the palm of his hand. Penny was aware each time he did it, aware that he was touching the instrument of her once death, and she shuddered every time. Finally, as Harry reached into his pocket yet again, she burst out,
"What if he doesn't stop? What if he drives clear down to London?"
Harry shrugged. "If it looks like he will, then I'll let him get as far as..." He came to a jerky halt as his fingers touched the awful knife and briefly closed his eyes behind their dark lenses. When he opened them again, his voice had turned cold and taken on a cutting edge.
"But he won't come to that. He has to stop. He has stopped now."
She clutched his hand. Do you know where?
He shook his head. No. The only way to find out is to go there and see.
Oh, my God, she whispered. I'm going to see the man who murdered me.
More important, Harry told her, he's going to see you, and he's going to wonder about you. If he reads the newspapers, he'll know that Penny, one of the girls he killed, had a lookalike called, by some peculiar coincidence, Penny. But he'll have a hard time believing he's actually happened across her. I mean, there are coincidences and coincidences. If he has any brain at all, he'll find it a damn suspicious thing. It will worry him. That's what I want to do, worry him. I think Johnny deserves something of a harrowing time before we even up the score more permanently.
We? She repeated him. It feels like you're using me, Harry.
I suppose I am, he answered her, allowing her to lead him out of the cafeteria into the night. Though not as hard as he did. He quickly went on. And don't tell me that's not fair. Fair is like beauty. It lies in the eyes of the beholder. Also, I'm not asking you to do much, just to be there. There's someone else with a much larger part to play.
Maybe you're right, she said, as he folded her into his arms, conjured a door, and carried her over the threshold into the Möbius continuum. About what's fair and what's beautiful, I mean. And it's a fact. I don't think there was anything of beauty in Johnny.
No, Harry answered grimly. And nothing fair about him either. But me, I'm fair. I only take an eye for an eye.
Chapter 7. Nightmare Junction. Johnny had stopped at an all-services motorway watering hole north of Newark. He'd chosen the A1T rather than the larger M1 because its service stations usually had richer pickings. Not only long-distance truckers and motorists used its facilities, but locals too. It was Johnny's experience that when the town and village dance halls slowed down around midnight, the young ones headed this way for a cheap motorway meal after a hard night's drinking, dancing and whatever. He'd stopped here before, but no luck as yet. Maybe tonight. On clutch and air brakes, he snorted and woofed the big articulated truck around the tarmac until he'd found a place to park it where its nose sniffed the exit route. It was as well to be able to drive out of such places with as little trouble as possible. The place was on a major junction. The car park was busy and the lorry park half empty. People came and went in small parties to and from the brightly lit diner. Johnny's would be just one more face over a plate of chicken and chips and a pint of alcohol-free. Inside, there'd been nothing much of a queue at the self-service bar. In a little while, Johnny had settled at a table in a corner booth where he'd toyed with his food and casually looked the place over for a likely female face. There were several, but they didn't fit his bill. Too old, too drab, slack-faced, sharp-eyed, accompanied, or stone-cold sober. A few bright-eyed young things, yes, but all hanging on to flash boyfriends. Well, that's how it went. But there were plenty more places just like this between here and London, and you never could tell when your luck was going to change. He remembered a time when, on a lonely stretch of road, this bird had roared up in a little red sports job. He'd bombed after her and forced her off the road into a ditch, then told her he was sorry and it was an accident, but he would be glad to give her a lift to the nearest garage. Oh, and he'd given her a lift all right, but not to a garage. And then it had been her turn to give him a lift. A really good one. A real high. Johnny had been in a weird mood that night. After killing her, he'd chopped a channel up under her jaw and fucked her in the throat. She'd felt it, of course, and how the dead bitch had yelped. Oh, she'd had a cock in her throat before, but not coming from that direction. Thinking about it had got him worked up. He must have one tonight, but not from this place. Maybe he should move on. And that was when he saw...
What the shit?
It wasn't possible, but he had to fight with his eyes to keep them from looking in her direction again. She was just over there. She'd just slid her backside onto a seat in a booth close by. There was a blind guy there, too, or a guy in dark glasses anyway, but he didn't seem to be with her. She had a coffee, just a coffee, and she was the same as last time. She was exactly the same. And for a moment Johnny's mind whirled, for he could swear he'd had this one before. How can that be? He asked himself. How can it be? And the answer was simple. It couldn't be, unless the girl was the other's twin sister, or her double. And then he remembered reading something about that in the papers, how they thought the one he'd had in Edinburgh, Penny, that was her name, was someone else. But then she'd turned up alive, the spitting image of the one he'd screwed, murdered and screwed again. Stranger still, the one who'd turned up had also been called Penny. Coincidence? Jesus, coincidence? But the biggest coincidence of them all, here she was, right now, right here. That is, unless he'd started seeing fucking things. Slowly, Johnny looked up from his food through the acid-etched, fern-patterned glass dividers, which loaned the booths a little privacy, until her face was directly in his line of vision. Maybe for a moment he caught her eye, but just for a moment, and then she looked away. The half-blind guy, the guy with the eye problem anyway, who shared her booth, had his back to Johnny. But he didn't look much anyway, slumped over his mug of coffee like that. Her father, maybe? No, her lover, Harry Keogh answered, but silently, speaking only to himself. Her vampire lover, you scumbag. He had been into Found's mind from the moment he and Penny had entered the place, and the mental cesspool in there was as rank as anything he'd ever come up against. Together with the necromancer's recognition of Penny as a former victim, or the victim's double, it strengthened Harry's resolve, confirmed his commitment. But as yet, Found's recognition of her hadn't produced the reaction Harry had expected. Curiosity, yes, but not fear. In a way, perhaps that was understandable. For after all, Found knew that the other Penny was dead. He knew that this couldn't be the girl he had violated. Still, his shock had been short-lived, and Harry was disappointed. Also, he knew now that he was dealing with a very cool customer. Whether Found would be able to stay cool when confronted with what was on the cards for him, that was something else entirely. Leaving Johnny's mind, the necroscope leaned across the table a little towards Penny and quietly said, I can see how badly shaken you are. I can feel it too. I'm sorry, Penny, but just try to stay calm. It won't be long now. When Found leaves, I'll go after him. You'll stay here and wait for me, okay? She nodded and said, You seem very, well, cold about all this, Harry. He shook his head. Just determined. But you see, Found is cold, which might give him an advantage if I allowed myself to get too heated. As he spoke, Harry saw two men enter the diner from the car park. They seemed ordinary enough, but there was something about them. As they moved along the self-service bar, collecting cold drinks, their eyes scanned the room, found the necroscope and Penny in their booth, moved on. Harry went to probe their minds, and his telepathic probe at once came up against a wall of mental static. He withdrew immediately. At least one of these men was an Esper, which meant E-Branch was closing in, on both Johnny Found and Harry Keogh. They probably wouldn't try anything in here, maybe not even in the darkness of the car park, but in any case, Harry didn't want them on his trail, and they'd obviously figured out that if they followed Found, they'd find a necroscope too.
Now of all times, he really couldn't afford this kind of complication.
Now too, he remembered the car he'd seen tailing Found's truck out of Darlington. An unmarked police car with, how many men aboard? Two or three? He thought they were all policemen, but now knew better. Suddenly coming from nowhere, he felt a growl rising in his throat. His vampiric side was reacting to the threat. Aware of Penny's gaze, he stifled the growl at once.
Harry?
Her voice was concerned.
You're very pale.
Fury, my love. There's something I must do, he told her.
It will mean leaving you here, but only for a minute. You'll be okay.
In here, alone with him?
Her eyes were huge and round. There are 50 people in here, he answered, and 2 of them at least are pretty sharp characters. I promise I'll be right back.
She touched his hand and nodded.
Then I'll be okay.
But she avoided looking Faun's way.
Harry stood up, smiled a robot smile at her, and went out into the night. At first, to anyone watching, it would appear that he'd been heading for the gents' toilets, but as he passed close to the swinging glass doors of the exit, he turned sharply and pushed through them. And as soon as he was outside, crouched down, breathed a mist, and moved wraith-like between the cars ranked as soldiers on the hard standing. His vampiric senses guided him. He went straight to the unmarked police car and approached it from the rear. There was a driver, a plainclothes policeman, with one elbow on the sill and a cigarette dangling from his lips, where he sat silhouetted in a steel frame, looking out of his wound-down window into the darkness and breathing the mild night air. Exuding fog, the necroscope moved like a low-slung spider, performed a weirdly loping limbo to draw silently alongside the car, and then he stood up. The policeman's jaw fell open in a gasp of astonishment as a shadow, coming from nowhere, blocked out the stars and flowed over him. His cigarette flew as the necroscope hit him once, hard enough to send him sprawling across the passenger's seat. He was out like a light, indeed like his cigarette, which Harry ground under his heel. Then he reached inside the car and snapped the key in half in the ignition. So much for that. They wouldn't be following Johnny or Harry anywhere in this car. But to be doubly sure, he took out Faun's steel tube knife and drove it into the wall of a tyre until it hissed air and sagged down onto its rim. But as he began to straighten up, he glanced into the back of the car and froze. The necroscope's eyes were attuned to the night, which was his element. He could see into the back of the car just as clearly as in broad daylight, and there on the back seat, a bulky, ugly, dark-snouted shape, which Harry knew at once, a flamethrower. And on the floor back there, the blue steel glitter of a pair of loaded crossbows. Loaded crossbows! Harry hissed and crouched down into himself. They were ready for him, all of them. It must be coming soon, perhaps sooner than he'd anticipated. Bastards! And he was the one who'd shown them how. He attacked a second tyre and grunted his satisfaction as it collapsed into extinction, then moved around the car and did a third, following which he paused and drew a ragged breath and forced himself to be calm. He was trembling, but only trembling. No more hissing, snarling, mere movements of violence, but they had acted as a safety valve on Harry's awful pressure. As his mist began to thin, he sighed his relief, stood more humanly erect, put away the knife, and headed back towards the diner. Mere moments, less than 2-3 minutes at most, but more than sufficient time that the menace of Johnny Faun had got to Penny, cancelling her former resolve to be okay. For she had known from the moment Harry left the glass door swinging behind him and disappeared into the night that she would not be okay, not in the same enclosed space as this monster, not with 50 or 500 people around her. Mere moments, yes, but enough time for Johnny to make up his mind that Penny would be the one. Obviously, the guy with the dark glasses hadn't been with her after all, and now she was on her own. What was more, she was aware that Johnny was interested. He could feel her avoiding his eyes, even avoiding his thoughts, his existence. And suddenly he wondered, does she know me? But how could she possibly know him? What the fuck was going on anyway? He put aside his plate and placed his hands on the table, palms down, as if to push himself to his feet. And all the while he stared at Penny, willing her to look his way. She was looking his way, however obliquely, and saw him slowly rising. All the colour fled from her face, and she too rose, slid out of her booth, backed away from him. She collided with a fat man with a tray and sent milk, hot food, bread rolls flying. Johnny paced after her, smiling a deliberately feigned surprise smile. It was as if he were saying, "What's wrong? Did I startle you?" Anyone watching would think, "What on earth is wrong with that girl? Is she drunk or on drugs? So pale. And that nice young man looking so surprised, so astonished." And that was the whole thing of it. Johnny Found did look like a nice young man. When Harry Keogh had seen him, he'd been surprised that he didn't more neatly fit the bill. Medium height and blocky build, blonde, shoulder-length hair, good square teeth in a full mouth with a droopy, almost innocent smile. Only his slightly sallow complexion marred the boy-next-door image. That and his eyes, which were dark and deep-sunken. And the fact that he lived in a pigsty, and that he was a cold-blooded ravager of both living and dead flesh. Penny blurted out an apology to the gaping, spluttering fat man where he fingered his milk-soaked jacket, looked up and saw Johnny closing with her, turned and fled for the swing doors. Johnny glanced around at the dozen or so nearby patrons in their booths, shrugged and pulled a wry face, as if to say, "A weirdo, nothing to do with me, folks," and calmly walked after her. But he was so intent on his act, and on following the girl into the night, that as he caught the still-swinging door on the inn swing and passed out through it, he didn't see the two sharp-eyed men starting to their feet and coming after him. Outside, Penny turned frantically this way and that. A thin mist lay on the tarmac of the sprawling tree-bordered car park. The headlights of the vehicle on the nearby trunk road blinded her where they went scything by. She couldn't see Harry anywhere, but Johnny Found could see Penny, and he was right behind her. She heard the crunch of gravel on the path leading back to the diner's door, but didn't dare turn round. Of course it could be anyone, but it could also be him. She felt rooted to the spot, all of her senses straining to identify if anything was going on behind her, but utterly incapable of turning round and using the most obvious sense of all. "And God," she prayed, "please let it not be him." But it was. "Penny," he said, sly and yet somehow wonderingly. Now she turned, but with a sort of slow-motion jerkiness, like a puppet controlled by a spastic puppeteer. And there he was, bearing down on her, wearing a painted-on smile under eyes that were jet black and flint hard. Her heart was very nearly stopped. She wanted to cry out, but could only choke. She almost fainted into his arms. He caught her up, looked quickly all around and saw no one, and, "Mine," he gurgled, glaring into her half-glazed, sideways sliding eyes behind their fluttering lids. "All Johnny's now, Penny." He wanted to ask her questions right now, right here, but knew she wouldn't hear them. She was sliding away from him, away from the horror of him, into another world, escaping into unconsciousness. That was a laugh. Why, no way could she escape from Johnny, not even into death. Here in front of the diner was the car park. Behind it was the lorry park, and dividing the two a belt of trees with paths between. Johnny picked Penny up, hurried with her into the cover of the trees, carried her through them light as a child. Behind him, the E-branch agent and a special branch detective inspector erupted from the diner, glancing this way and that, saw him hurrying into the darkness. They came running after him, and the necroscope came loping after them. Harry had heard her cry out, not aloud, for she'd been too terrified to make any sound whatsoever. He'd heard her in his mind. She was his thrall, and she'd called to him. The call had come just as he was leaving the disabled police car, and at first he hadn't known what it was, but the vampire in him had known. He had seen Found carrying Penny into the screening trees towards the lorry park, and he'd seen the two men from the diner running after him. All of them were moving quickly, but not as quick as Harry. His lope was more wolf, more alien than human, and he covered ground like the shadow of a fast-fleeting cloud under the moon. But as he entered the trees on a diagonal course, calculated to intercept Johnny Found and his captive, he knew he'd made a mistake. The trees and the shrubs beneath them were an ornamental screen designed to separate the two car parks, and as such they were protected by high wire mesh fences. Precious seconds were lost as Harry came up against a fence, cursed, and conjured a Mobius door.
In another moment he cleared the belt of trees and emerged on the perimeter of the hard standing, where a reeling, gagging figure collided with him and brought him to a halt. It was the Esper. He knew Harry at once, sensed the awesome power of his metaphysical mind, that of the vampire in him, and threw up a hand to ward him off. The hand was bloody as the gaping wound in his cheek, where Johnny found had torn a third of his face away. Harry held him upright, snarled at him, then thrust him towards one of the paths through the trees.
"Go and get help, quickly, before you bleed to death!"
And as the Esper choked out something inarticulate and staggered away, the necroscope reached out with his vampire awareness to cover the entire park. He found three people at once. Penny, unconscious, Johnny Found, furious and bloody, and the policeman, dead where Found's weapon had crushed through his ear to gouge into his brain. Harry pinpointed their location, conjured a door and ran through it, and out again at the rear of the Fridges express truck, where even now Johnny was slamming home the bolt on the roller door. At his feet, the policeman lay crumpled in a pool of his own blood, the left side of his face a raw red pulp. The necromancer had taken the policeman's gun. He sensed Harry's presence, whirled and aimed and fired. Harry was coming head-on. He felt the colossal blow as a bullet smashed into his collarbone on the right side, spun him round and hurled him down on the tarmac. Then, startled by the explosion and the flash, Johnny was fumbling the gun and dropping it. Stumbling across Harry, he kicked at him where he lay curled in his pain, and running past the trailer towards his truck's cab, the madman raved, cursed and laughed all in one. The pain in Harry's shoulder was a living thing that took hold of his flesh with white-hot pincers and twisted it, causing him to moan his agony, and he thought, "Bastard thing in my blood, my mind! Your fault, you berserk, headlong idiot! Very well, you've cursed me to be hurt. Now heal me!" Found was in his cab, starting up and revving the engine. Air brakes hissed and the reversing lights blazed crimson to match Harry's eyes, or the jelly coagulating on the side of the dead policeman's head. Racked by pain, the necroscope saw the huge bulk of the truck jerk, shudder, and start backing up. In another moment, a pair of its twin wheels skidded viciously, then gripped and dragged the policeman's body under. Blood and guts gushed as the wheels lifted up barely an inch and the weight of the truck crushed the corpse like toothpaste from a tube.
"He's lucky to be dead,"
Harry dazily, unthinkingly thought. "It's something he wouldn't want to happen while he was still alive." They were instinctive thoughts, shocked out of him by the squelching eruption of brains and shit and flailing guts, but they were also dead speak and the policeman heard him. Exhaust gases belched in Harry's face where he rolled desperately from the path of the reversing truck. The scarlet dripping wheels missed him by inches, but through all the roar and stink and mess on the tarmac, he heard and was riveted by the policeman's answer.
"But I feel it. Oh, God, it was like dying twice."
And Harry's blood, even his blood, froze as he remembered who was driving the truck. Johnny Found, necromancer, whose actions his victims could feel even as the teeming dead had once felt Dragasani's. Then the air brakes hissed again, and the truck jerked to a halt, shuddered, started forward, turned, and rumbled away towards the exit. Johnny Found was making his escape, with Penny aboard. But,
"No, you fucking don't."
Harry fixed the truck's location in his mind, got to his knees, toppled through a Mobius door, and out again into the refrigerated trailer. It was dark in there, but that was nothing to the necroscope. He saw Penny, crawled to her, put his left hand under her head, and drew it into his lap. She opened her eyes and looked into where they blazed.
"Harry, I didn't stay in the diner," she whispered.
"I know," he growled. "Did he hurt you?"
"No."
She shook her head, but weakly.
I think I just fainted."
Harry had no time to waste. Not now, for his blood was up, literally. "Cling to me," he said. She did as she was told, and Harry let the Mobius equations roll across the computer screen of his mind. One moment later, and Penny felt the awesome immensity of the Mobius continuum, and in the next, gravity returned where they fell prone onto Harry's bed in the house outside Bonnyrigg. "This time, stay here," he told her. and before she could even sit up, he was gone again. In the operations room at E Branch HQ, Millicent Cleary and the minister responsible sat with David Chung, who was also the duty officer, at one end of a large desk. The desk was equipped with a radio receiver, a radio telephone, standard telephones, blown-up ordnance survey maps of England under illuminated plastic, and a tray containing various small items of property belonging to branch agents in the field. Spotlights in the ceiling were concentrated on the desk, turning it and its immediate surroundings into an island of light in the large room's comparative darkness. Millicent Cleary had just a moment ago received a brief telepathic message from Paxton at the house near Bonnyrigg, stating that the assault team was in position. Keogh and the girl had been back briefly, but Paxton was sure that a necroscope was no longer in the house. Similarly, Frank Robinson, the spotter who was Paxton's partner on the job, believed one of the two was still there. Since there was no noticeable disturbance of the psychic ether, he would guess it was the girl. Keogh must have used the Mobius Continuum to drop her off at the house before moving on. If there'd been any indication that the necroscope himself was still in there, then the team would have maintained ESP silence. But since he wasn't, Paxton was eager to learn what was happening. Cleary passed the mind message on, and the minister responsible gave a snort.
"I've come to the conclusion that you're right about Paxton," he said. "All of you. I get the feeling he won't be satisfied until he's running the world."
Cleary frowned, however, prettily, and nodded.
"Ruining it, you mean?"
she said sourly, then quickly added,
"Sir? But we are right, and you don't have to be psychic to know it. He's a menace. We're lucky Ben Trask is up there keeping an eye on him. Do you want me to tell him anything?"
The minister looked at her, also at Chung, where he busied himself touching and concentrating on his many contact sigils in their tray, fathoming the whereabouts, mood and feelings of the agents in the field, and mentally reviewed the situation. The telepath Trevor Jordan, who by all rights and natural laws should be a small heap of ashes in a vase, was on a night train heading for London via Darlington. Two E-Branch agents were on the same train and didn't anticipate too much trouble, even though it was a pretty safe bet that Jordan was a vampire. They were equipped with powerful automatic weapons, and one of them had a small but deadly crossbow. Another man was on his way to the mainline station in Darlington to give them a hand. He had a car and, in its boot, a flamethrower. Penny Sanderson, also a resurrected vampire, was probably in Keogh's house outside Bonnyrigg. The agents up there were, again probably, as strong a team of espers as E-Branch could throw together, which they would need to be if or when Keogh rejoined the party, for the odds were that sooner or later he'd go back there for the girl. As for the necroscope himself, he could be quite literally anywhere, but he was probably tracking Johnny Found. His reasons for doing so were all his own, but the Sanderson girl had been one of Found's victims. Vengeance? Why not? It seemed the Vampiri had always been big on revenge. So if E-Branch moved now, two of the three targets were good as dead. The minister recoiled for a moment, shocked by the necessary cold efficiency of his own thoughts, but Keogh would still remain the big question mark, the pivot on which everything else turned, and it would be to everyone's advantage, literally everyone's everywhere, if the necroscope could be taken out at the same time as the others.
"Sir?"
The girl was still waiting for an answer. The minister opened his mouth to speak, but at that moment David Chung held up a hand and said,
"Hold it!"
Cleary and the minister looked at the locator. His other hand was resting on a Zippo cigarette lighter, the long-time property of Paul Garvey, a telepath working with the police out of Darlington. The hand was steady, the tips of Chung's long fingers motionless where they touched the cold metal, but the hand he held up was trembling violently. Suddenly, he snatched back his hand from the tray, stepped back a little from the desk. In another moment, he recovered himself, came forward again and said,
"Garvey has been hurt. I don't know how, but it's serious."
He closed his eyes and his hands hovered a moment over the map beneath their clear plastic laminate.
As the small Asian's hand came down to cover a section of the A1 north of Newark, the minister turned to Cleary.
Can you get hold of Garvey?
I've worked with him lots.
She was breathless.
Let me try.
She closed her eyes and concentrated on mental pictures of her fellow Esper, and got him at once. Garvey was in fact sending at that very moment, but his signal and message were weak, garbled and distorted by his pain, which Cleary immediately became heir to. She gasped and staggered and for a second lost him. Then she picked him up again, but barely in time before he blacked out and his telepathic thoughts flew into shards in her mind. The rush of psychic sendings had not been without images, however, which she'd received even as he was going under. She turned to the minister, and her features were drawn, bloodless.
Paul's face, she said. It's ruined. His cheek is hanging in tatters. But there's a doctor with him. They're in some sort of motorway cafe. I think he was attacked by Johnny Found, but the necroscope was also there, and a policeman is dead.
The minister grabbed her wrist, steadied her.
A policeman dead? And Keogh was there? You're sure?
She nodded, gulped.
It was in Paul's mind. A picture of a bloody hole in a policeman's head, and another of Harry, with eyes like red lamps burning in his face.
Chung said, Garvey's somewhere here, and he pointed at the map, on the A1. The minister took a deep breath, nodded and said,
This is it. It's all coming to a head, right now. Keogh might have guessed it all along, but by now he must know we're after him. So while all three of these creatures, are in different locations, from which two of them at least can't escape, now has to be the best time to move on them.
He turned to the girl.
Miss Cleary or Millicent, is Paxton still waiting? Get back onto him and tell him to move in now, at once. Then speak to Scanlan and tell them the same thing.
He turned to Chung.
And David.
But the locator was already busy on the radio, speaking to the people in Darlington. Meanwhile, by the time Johnny Found's thundering Fridges Express truck took the curves on the roundabout at the junction of the A1 and A46 outside Newark, he was much calmer and showing a lot of skill and driving discipline. Had there been a police patrol car stationed at the roundabout, its officers probably wouldn't have looked twice at him. There was no patrol car, however, just Harry Keogh. Using Found's knife, the necroscope had followed the truck's progress in a series of short Mobius jumps, waiting for his quarry to slow down a little before attempting what must be an extremely accurate jump onto a moving object, which was to say directly into Found's cab. Also, it must be accomplished as smoothly as possible, so as not to jar his badly shattered collarbone. The pain of that alone would have left any other man writhing on his back or entirely unconscious. But Harry wasn't any other man. Indeed, with every passing moment, he was a little less a man and more a monster, albeit one with a human soul. And as the necromancer straightened up his truck off the roundabout and back onto the A1, that was when Harry emerged from the eternal darkness of the Mobius Continuum into the empty seat on his left. At first, Found didn't see him, or if he did, he considered him a shadow in the corner of his eye. And Harry sat still and quiet in the very corner of the cab, pressed against the door with his face and upper body turned towards the driver. He kept his eyes three-quarter shuttered, studying Johnny's face, which had seemed previously scarcely to match up with any of the descriptions given him by the girls, but which he now saw to be very terrible indeed. As for Johnny himself, he knew that it was all over. Too many people had seen him tonight. In the diner, the car park, or with or close to the girl. Indeed, it seemed to him that he'd been set up. They had traced him, then trapped him with a girl who was the image of one of his victims, and he had fallen for it. Well, two of the bastards at least had paid for it, and the girl would pay too when he climbed into the trailer with her, chopped a passage through the orbit of her left eye, and fucked her brain. These were his thoughts, which Harry, looking directly at him, read as clearly, more clearly than the pages of a book. And if before there had been any doubt at all in the necroscope's mind that his course of action was the right one,
These were also the thoughts which dispelled it. Now, as Johnny dwelled more intimately on the pleasures he intended taking with or from the girl, Harry very quietly spoke up and said, "None of those things will happen, for the girl isn't in the trailer. I freed her, as I intend freeing all of the dead, from their terror, Johnny, from your tyranny." Johnny's jaw had fallen open at the first word. There was a trickle of saliva, slime, froth, in the left corner of his mouth, which now ran down under his lip and into the dimple of his chin. He said, "What?" and his coal black eyes slowly slid to the left in their deep sockets, then stood out like ink blots on the gaunt parchment, which until a moment ago had been the flushed, bloated flesh of his face. "You're a goner, Johnny," Harry told him, and opened his furnace eyes to reflect ruddily on the other's paralysed, astonished features. But Found's paralysis was short-lived, and the rest of it, his almost immediate response, was all instinct, so that not even the necroscope could have seen it coming.
"What?"
he gurgled, taking his left hand from the wheel and reaching up behind his head for a meat hook where it hung from the cab's frame.
"A goner? Well, one of us is, that's for sure."
Harry's plan had been simple. As Found attacked him, he'd conjured a Mobius door and wrestled him through it. But it was difficult enough just to take hold of the man in the cab of a truck, let alone when he was wielding a meat hook. Johnny had seen the huge bloodstain on Harry's jacket and recognized him as the one he'd shot in the diner's vehicle park. How he came to be in the cab was something else, but he surely wouldn't be much good for anything with a gaping hole in his shoulder, and even less good when Johnny was finished with him.
"Whoever you are," he grunted, swinging the hook, "you're dead fucking meat."
The blow was awkward and left-handed, but still Harry couldn't avoid it. He ducked down a little, and the question mark of shining metal passed over his right shoulder, swooped down on him, and caught him in the hole which the bullet had torn out of his back. He gasped his renewed agony as Found yanked him towards him and glared into his face. Then, using Harry as a counterweight, the necromancer lifted his left leg, reached it across Harry's knees, and kicked open the cab door. And as the truck careered down the twin lane, he kicked again, this time at Harry himself, and simultaneously released his hold on the meat hook. Sliding free of his seat into the rush of night air, the necroscope made a desperate grab for the wildly swinging door. Luckily, the window was down. As he looped his arm through the frame, so his feet slammed down onto the running board. Johnny could no longer reach him without letting go of the wheel, but he could at least try to shake him loose. Heedless of the other vehicles, the maniac threw his huge truck this way and that across the lanes, and Harry hung on like grim death until the thought suddenly occurred.
Why not a big door? Why not the biggest bloody door you could ever imagine?
On his left and almost directly under his skidding, skittering feet, a car was sideswiped and sent spinning, crashing through the roadside barrier in a shriek of ruptured metal. It smashed onto the embankment nose first and exploded like a bomb, but the big truck rushed on and left people frying and dying in its wake, and in the cab Johnny fueled himself with their pain and knew that even dead they would hear his crazy laughter.
"Enough!"
Harry thought, and conjured his giant door on the road directly in front of the truck. The rumble and thunder and rocking violence of the vehicle died away in a moment as it plunged through the Mobius door into darkness absolute. Likewise, the mad laughter of Johnny Found shut off as he delivered a single gonging thought into the awesome Mobius continuum.
What?
What indeed? The beam of his headlights went on forever, cutting a tunnel through infinity. But apart from the headlight beams and the truck where its mass surrounded him, there was nothing whatsoever. No road, no sound, no sensation of motion, nothing.
What?
Johnny screamed again, deafeningly, in both his and the necroscope's mind. But
no good shouting now, Johnny, Harry told him, hanging on to the door and guiding the truck, aiming it like a missile to its final destination. Like I said, you're a goner. And we're very nearly there. Welcome to hell.
Johnny let go the wheel and sprawled across the wide seat, reaching for the necroscope where he clung to the door of the cab. But too late. They were there, Harry conjured another door in front of the truck and pushed himself free, slowing his motion to an abrupt halt, and the truck went rushing on, out of the Mobius continuum to emerge inches over the surface of a narrow road. It crashed down, bounced, rocked and roared, and as its free-spinning tyres found purchase on the tarmac, so it rocketed forward. Johnny screamed as he saw the sharp bend coming up where the road skirted a long, high wall of ivy-clad stone. He made a desperate grab for the steering wheel, but the truck had already mounted the curb. It shot across a narrow strip of grass, tore through a mass of night-black shrubbery, slammed into the wall, and stopped. Stopped dead. But not Johnny. As the truck and its trailer concertinaed, as the wall cracked and sent stone debris flying, as massive petrol tanks shattered and showered fuel onto hot tortured metal, turning the truck into a blazing inferno, so Johnny was ripped out of his driver's seat and hurled through the windscreen. Bones in his left arm and shoulder broke, where, pinwheeling, he hit the top of the wall before crashing down onto something hard far on the other side. There was pain, more pain than he'd ever known, and then, apart from flickering firelight from beyond the wall and a booming, whooshing explosion as the emergency tank blew, there was a deafening silence. The silence of mental concentration, of knowing, even through waves of agony, that someone, several pitiless someones, were watching him. He cranked his neck up an inch from where the sharp gravel chips stuck to the tattered mess of his face, and saw Harry Keogh standing there, looking down at him. And behind the red-eyed necroscope there were other people, things anyway, which Johnny knew should never be. They came, crawled, staggered and crumbled forward, and one of them was, or had been, a girl. Johnny backed off, pushing with his raw hands, sliding on his belly and his knees, skidding in the bloodied gravel until he collided with something hard, which brought him up short. He somehow turned his head and looked back and saw what had stopped him. A headstone.
A fucking graveyard, he gasped.
And Harry Keogh said, "End of the road, Johnny." Pamela Trotter said, "You keep your promises, Harry." And he nodded. And Johnny found Necromancer knew what had passed between them.
"No!"
he gasped, then screamed,
"No!"
He would get to his feet, even broken, shattered, cut to ribbons. He would flee from the hell of it. But Pamela's friends fell or flopped on him and bore him down, and a hand that shed rotting flesh and maggots stopped his mouth. Then she came to him and searched among his rags until she found his new knife. And close up like that, badly gone into corruption though she was, even with the flesh beginning to slough her face, still he knew her. "You remember that good time we had?" she said. "You didn't even say thanks, Johnny, and you didn't leave me anything to remember you by. Well, now I think it's time you had me a small memento, or even a big one, eh? Something I can take back down into the earth with me, right?" She showed him his own knife and smiled at him, and her teeth were long where the blackened gums had shriveled back from them. Harry turned away and shut out the sight, shut out Found's silent frenzied shrieking too from his mind. But to Pamela he said, "Make sure you kill him." Except, too late. She was weeping her frustration. Or rather, too soon. Damn the bastard. "Harry, but he's already died on me." Harry sighed his relief and thought, just as well. She heard him, and a moment later agreed. "Yes, I suppose it is. Shit. I didn't want to dirty my hands on this filth anyway." And now Found's deadspeak reached out to both of them, to Harry and to Pamela.
What is this? Where am I? Who is it out there?"
Neither of them answered him, but the sheer weight of Harry's presence impressed itself on Found's mind like a light shining in through the stretched membrane of shuttered eyelids. He knew that Harry was there and that he was special.
"It's you, right?" he said. "The guy with the dark glasses. With some kind of magic. You brought me here with your magic, right?"
Harry knew that Pamela would probably never speak to Johnny Found. Neither Pamela nor any other of the outraged great majority. Instead of taunting the necromancer, they'd merely shun him, lock him up or out, like a leper. So maybe Harry shouldn't speak to him either, but simply go away. And perhaps that would be the most merciful thing to do. Except, Harry had a less than merciful thing inside him, which now caused him to speak up. "You had the same magic, Johnny," he said. "Or you could have had. You could speak to the dead. Could have trained yourself, as I did, to converse with them and befriend them. But no, you chose to torture them instead." Found was quick to catch up.
"So now I'm one of them, right? I'm dead and you did it to me. But just answer me this. Why?"
Harry could have explained that he needed to focus his vampiric passions on something, to have something to let them loose on, rather than on people who were previously his friends, which was to say E-Branch and the world in general. He could have explained, but didn't, for his vampire wouldn't let him. Found had been the cold, cruel, uncaring one in life. Death should be a cold, cruel place too, and just as uncaring. An eye for an eye. "Why did I kill you?" Harry shrugged, began to turn away.
"Hey, fuckface!"
Found shouted after him, defiant, furious even in death.
"That doesn't cut it. You had your reason, sure enough. Because of the dead? Shit, who gives a fuck for the dead? Come on, tell me why!"
And so, coldly, cruelly and uncaringly, Harry told him. "You're right," he said. "No one gives a fuck for the dead. And you, Johnny, you're dead. You want to know why?" And again he shrugged. "Well, why the fuck not?"
Chapter 8. The Vampire Killers. Even though the great majority no longer trusted him, Harry had always respected them. He thanked Pamela and those of her friends who had assisted in bringing Johnny Found to justice, and as they commenced their arduous return to what would be their final resting places, so the necroscope employed his metaphysical mind's fantastic equations and materialized a Mobius door. But in the moment before he stepped through it, an agonized voice, not deadspeak but telepathy, which, even as he received it, changed to deadspeak, reached out to him from a deserted stockyard not far from the mainline station in Darlington. It was Trevor Jordan, alive at first, then dead, turning to fused flesh, bubbling blood and charred, blackened bones, as a squad of former E-Branch colleagues torched him to a sticky, steaming cinders. "Trevor!" Harry gasped, his own agony almost as great as the telepath's as he received the full, searing impact of his final seconds. "Trevor! I'm coming! Right now! Just keep talking and I'll find..."
"No..." Jordan cut him off, as all the pain of a life at its termination faded away, and death's cool darkness crashed over him, laving him like an ocean wave.
"No, Harry, don't. Don't come here. They're expecting you, and believe me, they have the right gear. And anyway, you have no time. The girl, Harry, the girl!"
The necroscope understood. Of course, Penny. The branch had been closing in on him. They had closed in on Jordan. They would close in on Penny, and they'd be doing it even now.
"Trevor!"
Harry was torn, felt riven two ways. A secondary agony of frustration and indecision. But Jordan was right. No one should be put to such an agonizing death, and certainly not an innocent. Jordan had been just such a one, and so was she. No matter what name anyone gave her now, or what she would be tomorrow, tonight she was an innocent.
"You can't help me, Harry,"
Jordan told him, trying to make it easier for him.
"Not this time. You can only jeopardize your own safety, and Penny's. But it's okay, it's okay. I lived twice, which was enough, and dying twice was...
Oh, that was too much. I don't need any more.
In the Mobius continuum, Harry still felt himself dragged apart, pulled two ways. He moaned his horror and his anger as he deliberately shut Jordan's deadspeak thoughts out of his mind. Later, maybe later, he'd have time to thank him for the warning. But, as for now, Bonnyrigg. He emerged along the riverbank, well away from the house, emerged with the darkness shot with the crimson of his fury. Vampiric fury. The thing within him held sway, its awareness washed out from the necroscope like human, like inhuman, radar. It scanned the house, standing in darkness, except when Harry left here the lights were ablaze. Harry's telepathy was carried on his vampire probe. In the house, five people, five warm beings full of blood, five clever thinking creatures, and four of them possessed of wild, weird talents, but nothing so weird as Harry's. His metaphysical mind touched upon their minds, but guardedly, so they wouldn't suspect. Penny first, terrified for her life, but as yet unharmed. Then Guy Teal, an as yet undeveloped seer, given on occasion to glimpsing the future, which Harry well knew was an unwieldy, unforgiving talent at best. And Frank Robinson, a spotter with the ability to recognize another Esper on sight, or even in close proximity.